Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled, The Shamatha Doctor is In, Meditation Q&A with Lama Kathy, by Lama Kathy Wesley. After reviewing basic shamatha, calm abiding, meditation techniques, and leading a short session of sitting meditation, Lama Kathy takes questions about the practice and gives guidelines for knowing whether your meditation practice is progressing. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, what I have to say this morning is that I am incredibly delighted to be here. I'm starting to think that I'm getting to the age where it's really wonderful to be anywhere. So it's spectacular to have time to spend with you in this place today. I often say to people that you bring your sincerity to this place and it means a lot to us. You bring your goodness, you bring your sincerity, you bring your wish to work with yourself, work with your mind, work with your heart. You bring that to this place, and I really appreciate it. Because the goodness you bring here stays here. The goodness you bring here stays here, and it becomes part of this room, it becomes part of this place, it becomes part of all of us. And as we have seen in the world, when a lot of negative people get together, they can cause a lot of damage. But when a lot of positive people get together, they can bring about a miracle. And that was something that my teacher, an elderly Tibetan guy who escaped from Tibet in like 1959, they shot at him as he was going over the border. He brought that to his community of Tibetan exiles in India. And then when he was sent to the United States, which sometimes I think is a land of barbarians. When he was sent, I mean, think about it. You grew up with, you know, with horses and cows and an agrarian society, no TV, no radio, no nothing, no electricity. And then suddenly you're in America. It's a thing. The fact that he came to us in America and trusted us with the teachings that he had been given so painstakingly as a youth and as a young man, the fact that he brought it all here and gave it to us is nothing short of amazing. And so those of you who are familiar with our story know that we were able to buy a little old wooden church on this site in 1990, and that in 2016, someone set fire to it and burned it down. Now, they didn't set fire to the building, let's be fair. They set fire to the trash bin. In fact, they set 7 trash fires in our alley. And we were the only building that burned. So we felt that it was a sad situation. But what did we do? We said, well, a lot of people brought a lot of goodness to this place, so we're going to keep it here, and we're going to do it. We're going to continue here. And that old teacher didn't say, go to another neighborhood. He didn't say, you know, he said, stay there. You need to be there. Stay there. So here we are. And it took almost 8 years for us to completely finish the project, but here we are. And so we're here for you guys, and we're here to teach meditation every Sunday for free. Doesn't matter. Just show up at 10 o'clock. Go to the classroom downstairs. You can learn how to meditate for free. Because we feel like meditation and mindfulness is like, it's like life-giving. It gives life to people because it helps them get relief from a lot of the chatter, chatter, chatter. I don't know if you guys got that. I got it. You know, the brain chatter, it helps you get a little relief from that, and so you can feel more of who you are and think more of who you are and be with yourself in a different way than you are now. And so that is, to me, it's a gift to be able to do that. And it's a gift for y'all to be able to come here and practice it. And so that's what I'm talking about today, is meditation. I know some of you may have come hoping to hear Lama Tom today. He's out of town for a funeral. Everything's fine, but he's out of town today. So I'm your substitute teacher. I'm not prepared. Actually, I'm incredibly prepared, so. And the reason I'm prepared is because I got this book. My teacher wrote two books during his lifetime. He passed away in 2019, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. And this is, I think, one of my favorite books for people who are trying to understand Buddhism. And it's like, what is going on with Buddhism? What is it? It's called Excellent at the Beginning. Excellent at the Beginning, Discovering the Buddhist Way. And there's a chapter in here about meditation. And so what I wanted to do today is I wanted to talk a little bit about meditation and then do something that I do on occasion here. I don't always do it, but a couple times a year, I like to do what I call the meditation doctor is in. So if people have trouble with their meditation, or if they have questions about meditation, or if they struggle with certain things in meditation, we're going to have you come to the mic so that people at home who are watching this this talk later will be able to hear your question. If it's hard for you to walk to the mic, you can let me know, and I'll repeat the question for the microphone here. But we'll be doing that. We'll be opening the floor up in about 5-10 minutes, and then we'll spend about half an hour or so just doing questions and that sort of thing. But first, I think it's important to do a little meditation, because I know some of you were here for the 10 o'clock and you're like, what, more meditation? And the answer is, yep, it's what we do here. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you just a capsule meditation instruction. And then we'll sit for about, 2 to 3 minutes. It won't be tough. And then I'll give a short presentation. But the practice of meditation, first of all, I'll tell you what it isn't, what it's not. It's not going to sleep. Although not a bad thing sometimes if it's what you need. One of my Tibetan teachers, a real straight arrow of a guy who like always does things by the book, this teacher. Somebody said to him once, well, you know, whenever I sit down to meditate, I fall asleep. Is that okay? And he says, not the worst that could happen. And he said, besides, it shows that your mind is beginning to relax. Your mind is starting to relax. He said, you just got to find a way to let it not fall asleep. He said, but if you need to rest, you need to rest. So in any case, it's not sleeping. It's not going into a trance. It's not going somewhere else. It's staying right here where you are with who you are today, right now. And you're placing your attention on an object and trying to leave your attention on that object. Now, what you will notice is whatever object you pick, some people like to pick a visual object. They'll just put it on their table. I'm just realizing I didn't do the prayers. Oops, well, that's all right. We'll get to that in a minute. Visual object on the table. Although I think the cookie would be more fun to look at, don't you? No, I guess not. Sorry. Now you've got that on the brain. Let's see if we can fix that. You can have a visual object in front of you, and you're not burning a hole in it. You're not like looking. You're not like doing laser vision with it, right? You're just letting your eyes rest on it. You're letting your eyes rest on it. And then your eyes can look at it forever, really, literally. Your eyes can look at it forever, but then your attention is going to like go somewhere. It'll go in, your attention will like go into the past, or your attention will go into the future, or your attention will go to the, my leg itches. You know, it'll go into the present moment, right? And so our job as meditators is to notice that wandering. You notice it, you can even label it thinking. You can let it go and then consciously and purposefully return your attention to the object and think of that return as a fresh start. It's a fresh start. Not a mistake, it's a fresh start. It's not a mistake, it's a fresh start. You're starting over. Because then you'll get another few seconds of attention when you place your attention back on the object. You'll get another few seconds of attention followed by some more wandering. And so really the work of meditation is just placing your attention and then when it wanders, bringing it back. And doing this in as gentle and non-judgmental a way as possible. Because we got enough judgment. We get enough judgment every day, day in and day out. We get judgment from the family. We get judgment from the boss. We get judgment from ourselves. We get, you know, you get the picture. But we don't need to judge ourselves for our meditation. We just have to be present with it. And so with that incredibly short instruction, you can use a visual object or you can use your breath, the coming and going of the breath. You know, whether it's just that little sensation at the nostrils where the breath comes and goes, or if you find it better to follow the breath all the way out, follow the breath all the way in. You know, you can do it either way, following it out and then in, or just being present with the sensation of that breath as it comes and goes. So you got the technique down, placing attention, and when it wanders, gently bring it back. And think of that coming back as a fresh start. And then when we come back after the little sit, I'll tell you what my friend Julie, Dr. Julie, the brain scientist, has to say about that. So about 2 minutes of meditation, here we go. Put yourself in a comfy position, as comfy as you can be, while maintaining your attention. And then you can place your thoughts in the idea, I'm going to meditate for the next few minutes. I'm going to practice paying attention and bringing my attention back. And I'm going to do this not just for me, I'm going to do it for everybody, for the benefit of all beings. So we're going to sit and do some meditation now. That's a short meditation. So, the floor is open for questions. Questions, how was that? Was it easy, difficult? What do you think, guys? Anybody have questions about meditation or the technique you learned? You can ask anytime. I may have to, yeah, there you go, there goes one. Hey, David.
I guess you know that I always have something to say.
It's okay.
I have three questions, I hope brief. The first one is so large and existential that we may not understand it. Eyes open, eyes closed.
Yeah, eyes open, eyes closed. Yeah, that is a very popular question. It really is going to depend on the individual, and I'll tell you why. All of us are wired differently. Our brains and our bodies are wired differently. And this teacher, Situ Rinpoche, who was the same one who told me, you know, falling asleep is not the worst thing that could happen to you. He's a really marvelous teacher. And he said that some people do very well with their eyes open. And he said, and it is preferred for a person to have their eyes slightly open. And I don't know what the reason for that is, but I'll tell you what my supposition is, you know, my educated guess, is that it is because we're not trying to escape or shut out the world. We're trying to be present with the world in a different way. That's my opinion. But that being said, even though that is the ideal, there are some people who, because of their wiring, need to leave their eyes closed. Interestingly enough, I am one of those people. And I used to have my eyes open all the time. And then Sitra Rinpoche, this particular lama, said, well, you know, you are extremely nearsighted. And your eye muscles have to work so darn hard all the time because of the lenses you wear. And he said, you need to rest your eyes. So he said, for you, it's probably going to be better for them to be closed. So that was a revelation. But I still do a little practice with my eyes open because I want to be able to do it in both modes. So
when we're walking, gotta have your eyes open. We focus on something as we walk. It could be the breath. But can it also be other things, like the soles of our feet, balance, something like that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when you're doing walking meditation, the object of attention, as Kempo Kartha Rinpoche taught us, first of all, he said, in Tibet, we didn't do walking meditation. It's cold, you know. And, he said, if you read the sutras, the words of the Buddha, if you read the sutras, they said that you should walk with the gait or the steps of a crane. Now, that doesn't mean you like lift your leg way up and then put it down, because that's what a crane does. But what he meant was you are mindful to the movement of your feet. You actually pick up the foot and then place it, pick up the foot and place it. Different lamas teach this technique to Westerners different ways. But Kempo Rinpoche's technique was pretty easy for me because he had us lift the foot and then place it heel first, and then lift the foot and place it heel first, which for me is a little easier because I can keep my balance better that way. And that's really what he told us to stay with, just the feeling of the feet as they contact the floor. But it's not for everyone, so some people will be watching their breathing, or they'll just be aware of the sounds in the room and try not to get distracted by anything other than the sound. They just try to stay with the sound.
Now, you're paying attention. We just meditated and we were giving good thoughts to others. Mm-hmm. One of those could, from our prayer that we read, one of them is, may they have happiness and the cause of happiness and avoid suffering, the cause of suffering. What is the cause of happiness and the cause of suffering?
Yeah. And what you're referring to is, it's not on this page, but many of you will have seen, it's not on this particular prayer page, but there's a prayer called the Prayer of the Four Immeasurable Meditations. And I'm going to go ahead and recite the whole thing for the purpose of reading it into the record. And may all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they have that great happiness, which is freedom from suffering. May all beings dwell in great equanimity, free of attachment and aversion to those near and far. And so this really goes back to the initial teachings of the Buddha, the very first teachings that the Buddha gave after he attained his enlightenment. And when he had his spiritual awakening, he came to understand the causes of suffering and the causes of happiness. That's what he realized in his meditation. And he said that the cause of suffering was clinging and fixation. Some people use the word desire, and that's a fine word, but I really think that the word clinging and fixation is better because it refers to the habit we have as human beings to kind of clamp down on something and think of it as being solid and permanent and real, and then we react to it. You know, we get an idea about something, and then we hold that idea, and we don't want to take any more info in after that. You know, it's just like, you know. And so this clinging and fixation, particularly to our self-concept, like ourselves. And if somebody says something mean to us, or if somebody treats us poorly, or if we don't get something we think we deserve, we get angry because we're fixated on having everything go our way. And so it's actually not the desire to have everything go our own way itself, it's how much we cling to that and insist on it. And so that's really the cause of suffering, is this clinging. And so if clinging and fixation is the cause, then doesn't it stand to reason that the opposite of that is the cause of happiness, which is the capacity to let go of that fixation, let go of the fixation. Now, you can't do that like instantly. You can't say to somebody who's suffering, oh, just let it go. You can't do that because it's not nice. It's not right. It's not fair. But what you can do is you can help their mind feel a little more at ease. And so that as their mind feels a little more at ease, they're able to deal with things a little better. So that's, yeah, hopefully that helps. Yeah. Another question? Yeah.
Well, I had nine other questions.
Oh, now,
since,
come on.
Since yeah. There's another now, question.
I tell you
here.
What, we got, I tell you what, I love your sense of humor, though. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I guess I was just wondering about something I run into with meditation.
I may need you to speak into the mic. Yeah, sorry. Because, you know, I mean, yeah. Oh, there you go. Thanks.
I guess I'm wondering about something I run into almost every week in meditation. So I'll meditate, and I'll get to a point where I'm thinking close to nothing, empty space type thing. And then even though I keep my eyes half open, I'll see in the part of my eyes that are closed, like the red of my blood, almost like I'm becoming aware of my circulation.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But then eventually the kind of moving, you know, color, not color, starts to turn into like shapes. Like today I saw a house, and then
sure,
I saw
sure. Yeah, yeah.
The horizon of the ocean, just like
I get you.
Big and circular as that could be. And I'm wondering, am I onto something or am I falling asleep?
Yeah, no, I get you. Yeah. This is a fabulous question, because this question, my opinion, this question is not asked enough. Because this literally happens to every single person. I believe that this, what you're talking about, happens to every single person who meditates at least sometime, right? And so, like, what is it and how do we work with it? Once again, my teacher, Siddhartha Rinpoche, the one who said it was, you know, hey, falling asleep is not a bad thing. You know, he actually addressed this exact thing. He said, look, he said, when you are beginning to relax the muscles of your body, which is something that's a side effect of meditation, he said that some of the muscles that relax are around your eyes. And he said, so stuff is going to, you'll start seeing things. You know, he said sometimes people will, if their eyes are open slightly in meditation, they'll see patterns and shapes and so forth and so on. And he said sometimes they'll see recognizable patterns like you're talking about, or unrecognizable patterns, or just whatever. He said what you're supposed to do when this happens is you're basically noticing it. You just notice it, but then you go back to the object of the meditation, which is either the breath or something else, right? Because he said, don't put meaning into the images that you see. He said, because he said, you could even like close your eyes really hard and then stuff will instantly start appearing. You know, he said, it's not what arises that matters, but what you do with it once it arises, that's what matters. So it will either throw off your meditation to see these things, or you'll just say, huh, there's that, and then go back to the meditation. Because the world throws a lot of stuff at us every day. We see a lot of stuff, and we hear a lot of stuff. And what's happened to us is that we tend to be distracted by everything that happens, right? We're kind of like, you know, what was that cartoon with the dogs in it where the one dog kept going, squirrel, you know, it was one of those cartoons or something, right? So highly distractible. The dog was highly distractible. Sure. That was the joke. And we also are highly distractible. And so our job is to not pay attention to whatever appears, but just to stay with the technique. And what he said we'll find when you do that is that he said sometimes the appearances will just change or disappear, but they won't bother you. You know what I'm saying?
Something.
What do you think about that?
No, I guess I start to go back to my breathing when it happens. So it makes sense to me. Not assigning meaning to it, I think, is probably the part that was the most weighted for me. Like, okay, they're just...
The most what?
Most weighted for me. Weighted.
Tell me more about that.
Like, being able to just be like, okay, it's just a bird flying at my face for however long. It's just an image, which is, I guess, what I was... The main part of my question is whether or not, like, do these mean anything, or is it just, like, brain?
Right.
No, brain farts, basically.
You know. I get that because you know, in a way we want things to mean something, because I think a lot of it is because we have this thought about the world that it's mysterious and that there are things we can understand about it through our mind, right?
Yeah.
And I can really appreciate that, because after all, if we look at the example of the Buddha, he gained enlightenment by placing his attention on his mind and meditating with his mind and so forth.
Sure.
And we wonder, well, what will our practice of meditation be like? And how will our attainment of Buddhahood be? We wonder things like this because we would like to emulate the Buddha and like to be like that. I think the thing is, we have to be able to tell things that are just effects, side effects, from progress. Because meditation has side effects.
Yeah, it does.
And we have to not mistake the side effects for the goal. And so what's interesting is you asking this question is helping me to explain to everybody that side effects are not the goal, and we can't sit on our seat thinking, I want this particular side effect to happen, like right now. You know, and because then that side effect becomes what you might call a detour from the path.
Yeah.
And then you kind of wind up going around and around in a cul-de-sac and wondering where you are. You know, so it's why it's important. Now, it's not insignificant that things appear. It's not insignificant, but it's not the point. You see what I'm saying? And what Sita Rinpoche said, it means that you're actually becoming relaxed, which is excellent. You know, when those shapes appear, it's just like your eyes are relaxing, which is awesome, because we hold a lot of tension in our eyes and in our face and in our jaw. And if we can relax that, that's good. But there's like even more to it than this. There's lots more. And attention is just the beginning, and I'll read about that in a minute. But I really did that help with your question?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, actually, I have one more.
Say again, please.
I have one more.
Oh, sure. Go for it. Yeah.
Hopefully a shorter answer. The other main pattern that I notice in my meditation is, and this is whether I'm sitting meditation or I'm trying to just clear my mind and be mindful throughout my day and try to meditate all the time. I don't really have ringing in my ears in general, but when I meditate and I get to this place where there's nothing in my brain, it's like my brain immediately just goes, like we'll start having tinnitus or tinnitus or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like it's resisting actually being clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering about that, if that happens to others and what that is.
Yeah. I think,
I've been taking it as like, I must be getting really close if my brain is trying to scream at me instead of be clear.
Yeah. Well, you know, that happens, you know, really, because we're so used, we are so used to distraction and entertainment. We love to be entertained. We love to be distracted. We got basically this like, revving sports car engine of a brain, and we have to tell that rev, you know, sports car of a brain, gear back, please, you know, gear back, and that's not easy, and we think that it's weird, but it actually is what we're supposed to do in meditation, is just gear back, just, you know, don't zip, 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 don't be impulsive, don't zip around, you know. So learning to do that is not easy, as you're saying, right? And I think that that many people do have sounds that they are not aware of when they are doing other things. And that I have tinnitus myself, and I don't notice it for the most part, except in quiet moments. And I feel, knock on wood, very, very lucky that it's a comforting sound to me. It's not an upsetting sound at all. It's a comforting sound. And it's like, oh, I'm not alone, you know. But these things will happen as your habit of craving distraction is stymied, you know, as avenues of distraction are closed off, you'll find other ones.
Yeah.
And so your job is to work through them. But I do want to clarify one thing, and that is that you said that you try to clear your mind, and I just can't say this enough, that meditation is not making your mind empty so you don't have thoughts. It's learning to work with the thoughts that arise. Because my Tibetan teacher said, it's impossible to stop thinking. It's impossible. And when you try to stop thinking, he said that actually makes it worse. Because he said, you know, if you got a cat, you know, if you have a cat at home and you close that cat in a closet thinking, oh, well, the cat won't bother me if he's in the closet, the cat will go insane trying to get out of the closet. But if you open the door, the cat will be so relaxed that he or she will fall asleep in the clothes basket, right? Yeah. So the idea is the more pressure you put on your brain to, like, do this, be without thought, it's like your brain is going to rebel, and then you'll have lots of thoughts. So I try to tell people the goal of meditation is to place your attention on something, and then be dedicated to the process, of placing attention, and then be dedicated to the process of returning your attention. And that when you do that, then the side effect of that will be a sense of mental and physical balance. You'll feel more balanced physically and mentally. And that's one of the side effects of meditation that we can talk more about when we talk about the progressions that people come to in meditation, because there are basically four stages of this quiet sitting meditation, four stages to it. And then beyond that, there's more to learn about meditation and the mind. So this is, we're learning the basics right here. We're getting the fundamentals down.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, the clearing the mind. My first two teachers in Buddhism were very Zen, and so I still have a pretty heavy Zen bend. And so I was summarizing to the point of being inaccurate. You're much more accurate than I was. I'm trying to clear the mind. It's not exactly that. You're right.
Boy, I sure get that. Yeah, and you know, and every person's mind and body is different, and some people respond more to one approach, and some people respond better to another approach. So thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Okay, we got several lined up here, so let's rock and roll here. Yeah. All right. Hey there.
Hi. I'm good?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I know. It's like when you first hear yourself on the microphone in this room, it's like, what?
Yeah. So I'm naturally kind of restless, and when I meditate, I usually find myself moving in some way, or if I'm seated, I'll bounce my leg or something like that. I worry often that will distract other people in the area. Is it something that I should be trying to clamp down on that to avoid any kind of movement, or should I just kind of accept it and let it kind of flow?
I really, really understand this because I have a member of my family that experienced this, and they were having the same kind of problem, you know. And I think it's going to depend on your comfort level, first of all, okay? Because, I mean, you know, we're human, and we care about, I mean, we try to think we don't care about what other people think, but we do, you know, and we don't want to disturb somebody else, and I understand that. One of the things my teacher said is, again, everybody's wired differently. Part of the movement that happens is physical, because we're not used to it, but part of it is sort of psychological or mental, in that we're just not used to, so we're not used to it physically, and we're not used to it mentally. And so one of the ways to approach it would be to start with short periods of meditation, and then as you find out what kind of a meditator you are, some people are better at the beginning of a meditation, they're more able to follow the technique at the beginning, and then the longer they sit, the harder it gets to stay with the technique, and other people are terrible at the beginning, but then gradually get the hang of it, and then they're better near the end. And so if you're a person who's better near the end, well, yeah, you gotta sit for a while. You gotta sit for a while longer so you get to that spot. But if you're one of the people who is good at the beginning, but then, you know, the longer you sit, the more it begins to break up, then you really need to make your sitting periods shorter. And in a room like this, if you sit near the back of the room, we've got the door thing down now so that the door doesn't make a lot of noise, you know? And so you could even go out in the lobby and walk around a bit and come back and sit down again. We don't care. And I mean, you know, because it's better to kind of get the energy off, right? Or to sit for the second part of the session or whatever works best for you. And here's what Rinpoche said about the movement. He said there are several different reasons for movement. One of them is the sort of nervous movement, or like some people have restless syndromes, you know, where their legs are restless and they just like all the time are moving. And he was not as familiar with that. So that might need a special, you know, a little special attention. But he said if it's just movement that you make because you're not comfortable, like, you know, your foot is falling asleep or your back is hurting. He said what you do, he said, at the beginning, the first time you feel the need to move, the first time you feel the need, he said, just tell yourself, I don't have to do this right now. I don't have to move just now. Not just now. Not now. I'm okay right now. And then go back to the technique. And then he said the second time it comes up, then you can move. Mm-hmm. And he said, and the reason for this is because at first we are very impulsive with our movement. And he said, this way you get to stretch a little farther beyond where you think you can go with your movement. And so I don't know, is that helpful or?
Yes.
Yeah, and so I would say, he didn't tell us not to fidget. He didn't tell us not to fidget. Because what he told me was, he said, look, meditation is new to a lot of people. It's new. He said in Tibet, everybody was meditating, or at least knew what it was. He said here, it's not the case. And so because people don't grow up with it, they don't know it, he said, you got to make them comfortable at first. You know, just tell them to sit well, you know, sit so that they're attentive and not slumped over or not, you know, whatever. And then he said they can adjust their posture. It's fine for them to adjust their posture, but just tell them to, like, stretch it out a bit before they move.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And then slowly, over time, you'll notice if that's the cause, if it's just the discomfort. And then the other thing to do is to talk to the meditation instructors here, and then they can help you, like, with specific things to, like, if your ankles are falling asleep, you can put, like, a rolled towel or a bean bag under your knee and stuff like that. That'll help your keep your pieces of your body from falling asleep.
Thank you.
Okay, no, thanks. By the way, guys, these are great questions. I'm really glad that I get to do this from time to time. Yeah. Yes, hi, Claire.
Hi, Lama Kathy.
Yeah, hi.
The hardest part of meditation for me has been sticking to it every day.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice for developing and sticking with a daily meditation practice, even when life gets busy or hectic?
Yeah. Let me say at the beginning, these are all incredibly good questions, because I think everybody has these questions, so I'm super glad you're asking. There's a couple different factors that figure into a person establishing a habit. Mm-hmm. And one of them is making the thing you are trying to make a habit, taking a bite-sized chunk of it rather than a whole lot. So I think that's the first thing is to, what I tell people to do is I say, you know, create an idea for yourself of your minimum daily meditation habit, you know, that like I'm going to do 21 mindful breaths every day, regardless of what mood I'm in or what's happening or anything. And then if you set your daily minimum really low, that's actually good, because that way you can't fail. That was what one of my lamas told me. He said, set your minimum daily practice level so low that you can't help but do it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, get your family to help you. Like, hey, did you meditate today? You know, I'm just saying, you know, for people in relationships and stuff, you know, my husband is so funny. He's like, did you meditate today? It's usually when I'm in a bad mood. Anyhow, but okay, so that's one.
Aim low at the start.
Just go for something simple that you know you're going to do every day without fail, because then it's a little easier to establish the good feeling that comes from doing something you want to do. Mm-hmm. Second factor, look at your day. Just look at your day and find a place in your day where it's really convenient to put that bite-sized chunk. Mm-hmm. And for every person, it's going to be different. Lama Karma, when he was here last year, he said for him, it's like right when he wakes up. He says he doesn't even wait to get out of bed. He sits up in bed and does some mindful breathing. And he says, I start my day with a feeling of gratitude, like, hey, I woke up. Good. I woke up today. I'm not dead. All right. You know, so, and then after that feeling of gratitude, then he does some mindful breathing. And because he's a dad, he's got a young son, and, you know, his wife and he look after their young son, and so he's got dad duty, you know. So for him, it's the first thing when he wakes up in the morning, because then he doesn't forget it. And then other people will have to look at their day, like right after I get home from work, maybe that's the time. I'll have a cup of coffee, or I'll sit with my coffee. I had a friend, every day during the school year, she put her kids on the bus. And then as soon as she got back from putting her kids on the school bus, she'd pour a cup of coffee and sit with her newspaper and read the newspaper. I said, well, just leave the newspaper on the kitchen table. Take your coffee into your meditation room and then just do it there. Mm-hmm. And that worked for her. So if you look at the day, at your day where you're already sort of on pause for something else, that might be a good place to put it.
Gotcha.
And the last factor, ask for help. Ask the Buddha to help you. Because my teacher, my very first practice, you're not going to believe this, when I first started practicing Buddhism, my teacher's very first, you know what the first thing he told me was? He said, when your mind is feeling unsteady, how could he know that about me? That I had an unsteady mind? How could he know that? But anyhow, when your mind is unsteady, he said, think of the Buddha and pray to the Buddha. And I'm like, oh, I've got somebody I can ask for help. And so that's what I would do also, is when you think about your struggle and you feel that you're alone in your struggle, mm-hmm. just say, wait a minute, I've got the Buddha. Buddha's got my back. And so say, okay, Buddha, look, I'm having a hard time. Help me out. Just whatever it takes, put it in front of me. You know, just bring into my life the thing I need to have in order to get better with this. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it would be then to strengthen the bodhisattva motivation. You know, a bodhisattva is a person who wants to benefit beings. And so benefiting beings is a powerful inspiration to get on your seat, like, the way I am now, I cannot help beings, but I want to help beings, so let's internalize that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So to summarize, aim low at the start, find a time that works good for me with my schedule, and then ask for help and strengthen that motivation.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Yeah.
So I've had a daily practice for a while now, and it's been going well. But when I sort of look at it, I can see that actually by far the majority of the time I'm practicing, my mind is not at all anywhere near the object of attention. Like at least 90% of the time, my mind is telling stories. I have a hyperactive mind, so it's planning things, and it's not where I want it. So. You know, like for minutes, it'll do that, and then I'll remember, and I'll have 5 seconds. So I'm like, oh, right, I'm meditating, and I keep that in mind, and I come back, but then off it goes again. So, you know, I see the benefits of meditation in my life. I have more attention in off the cushion, which is wonderful and why I keep meditating. But how much of a problem is it that it seems like my actual stability in shamatha is, it seems terrible to me, really. And I guess, is it just a matter of practicing? It'll improve, or do you have any advice?
Yeah, again, super glad you asked, because this gives me an opportunity to talk about the four stages of shamatha. And the fact of the matter is, you are at least the first stage of shamatha, of the four stages. And you can, the four stages of shamatha are talked about not in this book, but in Kempo Karthi Rinpoche's other book, the Dharma Paths. He said, here's my initial answer is, actually, I think you're doing better than you think you are. I think that's the first thing, because you're noticing. You're noticing that you're not on topic. And what I think is that because of the world we live in now that is so full of distraction, and like anybody who has like a smartwatch or a cell phone almost has more distraction than anybody has ever had in the history of the world. That, oh, is that an exaggeration? Maybe, but maybe not. So we're in a world that is very production oriented. We want everybody to be productive, and we live in a world where people enjoy being productive. It brings joy to people to be productive. But the fact of the matter is, it is, so number one, you're doing better than you think. Number two, my friends in the 12-step program will understand the phrase, keep coming back. I know it means keep coming back to meetings, but in this case, it's like keep returning to the object of attention over and over again without judgment, without judging, like, oh, I'm doing a bad job at meditating, I should be doing better, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's like, without judgment, just keep coming back, never stop, you know, never stop coming back to the object, because that in itself, that noticing and letting go of the distraction and returning, because I'm like everybody else. I sit there, and this morning I was leading a chant, and I lost my place because I took my attention off of it for a minute to think about something else. And multitasking is a myth. Kempo Karthi Rinpoche said, he said, yeah, you like to think you can do more than one thing at a time. He said, but you can't. He said, what's really happening, he said, is when you think you're doing two things at once, he said, what's actually happening is that your attention is actually toggling. He didn't use that word, but it's actually toggling back and forth very incredibly rapidly between two things. It's just going back and forth really, really rapidly, so you have the illusion that you're doing two things at once. He said, but your mind can only be doing one thing at a time, ever, ever. And so that's why meditation is such a challenge for us, because the idea of doing just one thing, it's hard, man. And it's like, well, because, you know, FOMO, right? Fear of missing out, you know, we don't want to miss out on something, or we don't want to miss an opportunity to be productive and all of that, you know. So we're going to have this habit of distractibility probably till Buddhahood, okay? Which is why it's so nice to take periods of time and do retreats where you do a little bit more practice. Kempo Karthi Rinpoche said visualization practice, even though we think of it as mantra and visualization practice, like when we're chanting, doing the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, or and visualizing the Bodhisattva Chenrezig and stuff, he said that's actually a form of shamatha. And if you can stick with some facet of that meditation, just if you can just stick to one thing, if you just keep coming back to different aspects of the meditation, you're still doing it. Even if you're not like 100% glued to one thing in the meditation, like the visualization, or one thing in the meditation, like the mantra, you're still filling your experience with something beneficial, okay? You see what I'm saying? Yeah, yesterday, by the way, yesterday was the saint was my saint's day, Saint Catherine of Siena, and I was reminded of her quote, "All the way to heaven is heaven if you practice, you know, if you practice the continuous presence of the divine," right? Well, for us, if we at least keep our mind somewhere in the practice, we're being effective. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And okay, so if I'm understanding correctly, I tend to prefer, I think, deity practice and mantra because there are multiple options right. for my easily yeah. bored mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're saying if I want to focus on the mantra or the visualization, or Lama Karma even told me once that you can just think about impermanence. So even, like, it's okay to switch between those during one meditation
mm-hmm.
session?
Absolutely. You can switch objects as long as you do not do so impulsively. That was what Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said. He said, because some people will change their object of meditation and they'll do so, you know, impulsively, like, oh, I got to do this. Oh, I got to do this. Oh, I got to do that. You know what I'm saying? So he said, just try not to be impulsive about it. Try to be deliberative in how you move from one thing to another, because that really is the maintenance of attention throughout something. I have a lot of friends who are musicians, and, you know, muscle memory is a real thing. And so when you play an instrument or you sing a melody, you know, it takes a lot of focus to stay with it, right, and not lose where you are and not lose the rhythm and things like that. And there will be moments where you drop out, where something will drop out, but you still come back because you're still performing and somebody is actually watching you, you know. So, so the idea is that you have to maintain that continuity. You have to maintain the continuity of virtue, the continuity of doing virtuous things. And all of these things, visualizing, mantra, and so forth, are establishing a continuity of something that is positive, at the very least. Trolloc Rinpoche talks about this in his book on karma, and there's not enough time to talk about that today. But you can go, it's somewhere around chapter 7 or 8, you can read about that.
Thank you.
Okay, because of time, we actually have to stop, so I'm going to summarize the four stages of shamatha. You guys have been incredibly patient listening to all the questions and the answers, so I want to thank you for that. There is a small chance that this lecture will continue next week because I may be needed next Sunday to give the Dharma talk again. If so, then I promise to get to this quotation. But what Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said about the four stages of shamatha, he said the first stage of shamatha, he used the example of water, moving water. So he said the first stage of shamatha, your mind is like a waterfall. You have a lot of thoughts and they're very speedy. They're very fast. Lots of thoughts. And they're rushing. But the fact is, you notice them, which you didn't notice them before. And so that's why I'm saying you're ahead of the game with the last questioner, because you're noticing that they're speedy and that there's a lot of them. And so then just, again, persist with returning to the technique and returning to the, just persist, you know? And then eventually, then you'll get to the second stage of shamatha, which is like a rolling river. The amount of thoughts, you still got a lot of thoughts, but they're slower. Their speed has slowed down some. You've noticed that they're slower. Third stage of shamatha is like a lake with waves created by the wind, you know, so a lake with waves. So again, you're able to actually have calm in between periods of thought. And then finally, the fourth stage is the windless, waveless ocean. The windless, waveless ocean, where things are very still. And that may not happen for a long time. It's okay, because if you're somewhere on that continuum, you're still practicing. And it's still effective, and it's still going to help you. And like I say, next time I talk, I'll talk a little bit about the what to do next, what happens, what comes next after doing these shamatha. So you guys, again, you've been incredibly patient. Let's sit quietly for a moment and dedicate the goodness of our session. Rather than doing a prayer today, we'll just sit quietly and think, we dedicate the merit and the goodness of this session to all sentient beings. We make the aspiration that all beings are free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the merit with this thought in mind. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Be safe out there. Have a good week, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Thank you to the sound department.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.